This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Justine Paradise here in the studio with Hannah McCarthy and Ben Henry. Hey, guys.
Hi, Justine.
Hiya.
So, Hannah, there's this woman you've been talking about for a few months now at story meetings here at the station, and now we're finally going to get to hear the story, right?
Yes, right. So, you guys, you know, I don't know if you've noticed, but in these meetings, whenever I bring up Barbara Follett, everyone asks me again, who is this woman who you're working on a story about? Have either of you ever heard of her?
I have no idea who that is.
No, not a peep.
Okay, so the weird thing is, in her day, she was pretty famous, and not actress famous or politician famous, but famous for this really unusual reason, the kind of reason that you'd think people would remember.
Hmm.
And then she just kind of fell off the map.
And this is a New Hampshire native we're talking about?
It's a New Hampshire native, yep. She was this big adventurer, but I haven't met anyone from New Hampshire who's ever heard of her either.
It's so wild how that can happen, that someone can be just so well known in their day and we don't know a thing.
Yeah.
So can we hear the story?
You want to learn about her?
Mm-hmm.
Let's do it.
Let's put her back on the map.
In 1927, the New York literary scene erupted with praise for a new author. The Saturday Review of Literature called her book, quote, almost unbearably beautiful. The New York Times praised, quote, the most authentic and unalloyed document of a hitherto unrecorded phase in plastic intelligence. The novel was called The House Without Windows, and it became an overnight success. Its author, 12-year-old Barbara Follett of New Hampshire, was officially a child prodigy.
Well, her father was teaching English at Dartmouth College. She was born in Hanover.
This is Stephen Cook.
Barbara Follett is my mother's half-sister.
Stephen keeps a website dedicated to Barbara's work. He named it after the planet that Barbara invented in one of her early writing projects, Farxolia.
You know, my life has been it's not quite as exciting as Barbara's. I like to live vicariously through her a little bit, I think.
Stefan says he didn't hear much about Barbara when he was a child. And when he started a genealogy project a few years ago, the plan was to research the whole family. But it was Barbara's story that really grabbed him. He visited the archives at Columbia University, where her papers are stored, and he started making copies.
And then, you know, reading them, rereading them, I absorbed them. That's how it changed my life. I'd never been so invested in any one life, any other life.
Barbara's life was, by most measures, an unusual one. She operated with a freedom unique for a young woman in the 1930s. And then, one day, she disappeared.
She vanished when she was 25, and no one knows where she went.
Escape and adventure came naturally to Barbara. She was homeschooled. Her parents gave her the freedom to pursue anything she wanted. And the very book that made her famous, The House Without Windows, is the story of a successful escape. A young girl named Ypersip slips out of the family home and lives the life that she wants. She can't stand the confines of creature comforts or family life. Instead, Ypersip makes her home outdoors. Her parents pursue her and she evades them. She follows her every whim. Barbara describes the abandonment of environments the way a person might explain why they suddenly left a relationship.
She could stand it no longer. Her heart gave way. She decided the next morning she would satisfy her longing. She wept to think that she was leaving it, but her love for the sea had become greater than her love for the meadow. And then she went away, sadly, yet happy at the prospect of a new and beautiful life by the foaming, churning rocks and the white-capped waves.
Barbara was just 8 years old when she started hammering this book out on her father's typewriter. By 12, she was famous. A year later, at 13, she became fascinated by pirates.
And basically bullied her parents into allowing her to sail on this ship up to Nova Scotia, two-week cruise.
Today, letting your kids roam the neighborhood without adult supervision is called free-range parenting. Back then, Barbara was hitting the high seas without her parents at 13. Her second book, The Voyage of Normandy, was published shortly after Barbara turned 14. It was a memoir of her time at sea, and it was immediately successful. But the elation of these moments didn't last. Not long after her second book was published, the family split. Barbara's father left for a woman half of his age, and Barbara and her mother were suddenly at a crossroads.
So now she's 15, never been to school, and mother and daughter aren't really sure what to do next.
They sailed to the Caribbean, the South Seas, and then California. Once on the West Coast, Barbara's mother tried to do something she'd never done before, give, or maybe force, Barbara into a more traditional environment for someone her age. She tried enrolling her in school, but it was too late for that. Barbara was an entrenched adventurer.
And we don't know exactly how many days this experiment lasted. Very few, I'm sure, because she quickly ran away to San Francisco, leaving a note saying, "I'm not going to tell you where I'm going. You know, one day we'll meet up again."
Police found Barbara holed up in a boarding house. Remember, she's still just 15. She tried to flee out a window.
That running away was in the newspapers all over the country. It was on the wire services because, you know, the child prodigy has run away from home.
Barbara and her mother eventually ended up in New York City, and Barbara began working as a secretary and on a new book. She was just 17, and New York was exciting at first, but that didn't last long.
It quickly takes its toll on her, and she starts writing her third book, which was never published, but it's called Lost Island. It's semi-autobiographical, about a young woman, really, who has a job in New York City and just can't take it anymore and wants to escape.
So Barbara did escape, once again. She quit her job and took to the Appalachian Trail with a young Dartmouth grad, Nickerson Rogers, who she'd met the summer before. The trail was more idea than reality in 1932, so the going could be rough. But Barbara loved it. She wrote jubilant letters to friends.
"I've jumped the whole structure of what my life was before. I've jumped the job, jumped my love, jumped parental dependence, jumped civilization, made a pretty clean break, and I'm happier than for years."
Barbara and Nickerson fell in love. They traveled to Spain and worked for their supper. When Barbara was 20, they got married. And then things started to slow down. Nickerson got a job at Polaroid, and they got an apartment in Brookline, Massachusetts. Barbara worked as a secretary and on her book, and Barbara saw markedly less space in her life for capital A adventure, as she called it, though she did describe her life at home as a quiet sort of adventure. And she still managed to have a relatively active life, spending a month in Canada with a friend on a canoe trip, or going to California to take dance classes with Martha Graham.
Nickerson writes her a letter while Barbara's off doing this class in California, interpretive dancing class. And so Nick writes her a letter saying, "You know, Barbara, I want to get a divorce." And Barbara is just flabbergasted. She has absolutely no idea why Nickerson wants to divorce her.
Barbara set her mind to fixing the marriage. Eventually, she discovered that Nickerson was having an affair, but she tried to ignore the fact that there was another woman involved. Her life was beginning to look very much like her mother's before her, despite all of Barbara's efforts to break with convention.
But the writing is on the wall, apparently, and on December 7th, 1939, she leaves the apartment and is never seen again, 25 years old.
On December 7th, 1939, Barbara Follett took a notebook, $30, and slipped out of the apartment she shared with Nickerson in Brookline, Massachusetts. Nickerson waited 2 weeks to report her missing. The couple had been feuding, and anyway, Barbara was fiercely independent and had run off before. Her family took it for granted that Nickerson was searching for their daughter. But weeks turned into months. A year and a half after Barbara disappeared, her father Wilson published an anonymous letter to her in The Atlantic, a way to reach out to her without drawing too much attention to the family. "How deep, instinctive, and unshakable is my faith that you live and remember," he wrote. "And in your own time, you will let us know how you fare." Nickerson divorced Barbara 3 years after she went missing, and as far as anyone can tell, he didn't put much effort into looking for her. Eventually, Barbara's papers went to Columbia, and then her books went out of print. Maybe Barbara simply went underground, lived out her life in secret under an assumed name. Stefan, her nephew, says you can't rule it out.
If she wanted to escape and not be found, Barbara was the perfect person to do so.
Of course, it's hard not to consider the alternative, that she died not long after she disappeared.
Part of me definitely wants to know, but what would happen if once I find out? If I ever do, which I kind of doubt if I will find out, you know, conclusively. Maybe I will. It would be hard to learn that she died at age 25 or 26 with so much left ahead of her.
Even though Barbara's story was dormant for so long, Stefan wasn't the only one to want to know more about her. Just a few years ago, someone else decided to look for her.
Yeah, I mean, I was attracted to Barbara's story immediately. Like, she's sort of the type of, you know, literary idol that I always keep an eye out for, you know, sort of like the tomboy type, the adventurous type.
Laura Smith read about Barbara in Lapham's Quarterly in a story by writer Paul Collins.
I was the age that she was when she disappeared, when I found out about her. And so that was already intriguing to me. And then, you know, after reading the article, I looked into some of her writing and I read her novel and just started trying to read a little bit more about her life. And it was then that the story sort of really stuck its hooks into me.
It wasn't the mystery that drew Laura in. She realized that she shared an ethos with this long-gone prodigy. Laura was about to get married and was feeling the tension between living a life of adventure and following convention. Barbara's life had been almost entirely adventure until she married at 21. Her story could be seen as a cautionary tale for getting mixed up with societal expectations, or perhaps a warning against a singular pursuit.
It gives you a lot to think about in terms of, like, self-mythologizing. You know, her parents mythologized her, and she also, you know, she mythologized herself. Like, so much of her life was about creating this story of the brave girl adventurer. And then, you know, later in her life, when she had troubles in her marriage, it was like everything that she had been mythologizing her whole life came into conflict with it when her husband, you know, suddenly wanted to leave her. And suddenly she was pleading for him to stay home. You know, it really became sort of the old self, the mythologized self, coming up against, you know, the self that we find ourselves in reality, the sort of, like, you know, the less glamorous version, which is sometimes our marriages don't work out.
When the glamour and self-determination fell out of Barbara's life, she ran away and never came back. And as Laura sees it, that vanishing was twofold. Barbara, the woman, the wife, the friend, and daughter, was gone. But Barbara the myth was gone too. The child prodigy and successful novelist and great adventurer faded out of collective memory.
And not only did her parents not really look for her, but also, like, America had sort of forgotten about her.
What remains of Barbara Follett is contained in the notebooks, papers, and manuscripts she left behind. She lives in the archives at Columbia, and in the research that Laura Smith and Stephen Cook continue to pursue. Laura called her book The Art of Vanishing, which is exactly the craft that Barbara spent much of her young life perfecting. Unless she is exceptionally long-lived, the vanished Barbara Follett has passed away. But the memory of her and the reality of her mythologized life has been incidentally revived by a writer and an estranged nephew. She is probably better known today than she's been in 75 years. After all of his time researching, Stephen Cook compiled her letters into a book, Barbara Newhall Follett, A Life in Letters. And he hopes to publish Lost Island, Barbara's New York escape novel that never made it into bookstores. He hopes, just as Laura Smith does, that this is a way to keep Barbara's memory alive in the literary world, whether or not the mystery of her life is solved.
She could have been anywhere.
She could have gone anywhere.
Well, okay. What do you think happened?
Who knows?
I really want... Have you read the house with that windows?
Mm-hmm.
That feels like that must be... Like, if this is the mystery, that's our body of evidence.
Yeah, so she was given, like, so much room when she was a kid. She ran away a lot. I wonder if that made her restless later when she became an adult.
Yeah, I think it must have made her restless, right? Because she was so adventurous, but then the world responding to her encouraged that adventurousness. So when her life got really real and messy and unpleasant, I think she must have felt that that was untenable. I mean, I'm projecting on her, but it just seems
like...
That's
all we can do.
That's all we can do. Yeah, unfortunately.
It's crazy to me that nobody really noticed that she disappeared. There wasn't any kind of, you know, public acknowledgement that this really kind of dramatic thing happened.
Yeah, and I talked about that with Barbara's nephew. I think it was a combination of this husband who already wanted out of the marriage, and then there was the fact that the family didn't really want this kind of thing in the press. They were kind of a private family. And then these parents who already thought of Barbara as this great adventurer, as someone who might run away. And anyway, they assumed that her husband was looking for her because that's what a husband ought to do, right? And that makes Barbara's first book, you know, when she just starts writing this when she's 8, it's so eerie because there's this character who flees these environments as soon as she starts longing for something else. And at the end of The House Without Windows, that character, Ypersip, literally vanishes into thin air. She becomes one with nature.
It's like a funny foreshadowing of what ended up happening.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Hannah, thanks for telling the story of Barbara Follett.
You're welcome.
What do we have coming up next?
So we actually have another story of a forgotten New Hampshire novelist. This one also happens to be a woman, but in very different circumstances. The story is by our executive producer, Erica Janik. It's the tale of Harriet Wilson.
The tale of Harriet Wilson coming up after the break here on Word of Mouth. Stay with us. Welcome back to Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Justine Paradise. Joining me in the studio today are Hannah McCarthy and Ben Henry.
Hey, Justine.
Hiya.
Hey, guys. So our next piece was produced by our executive producer, Erica Janik, who is actually on vacation. But before she took off, she left us with another installment of our New Hampshire First series.
Yeah, so when we first launched this series, we got an email from a woman who's on the board of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire. And she told us about a number of firsts among African Americans in New Hampshire, including the first known African American published novelist, Harriet Wilson.
And this was the first African-American novelist who was published in New Hampshire?
No, she was actually the first African-American novelist who was known to be published in the country.
That is nuts. We don't have a lot of African-Americans in our state at all, so it's wild that that happened here. So without further ado, here's the story from Erica Jenick.
In 1859, a Mrs. H. E. Wilson published a novel at her own expense. The book told the story of a biracial girl named Fredo, abandoned by her mother to be raised by a prominent family, where she suffered verbal and physical abuse at the hand of her employers, in a New Hampshire town famous for its abolitionist activities. The novel didn't sell well, likely less than 100 copies, and the book, as well as its author, fell into obscurity.
So in 2002, there was an article in our paper. In February 2002, a reporter wrote Milford's Forgotten Daughter, and that was the first reference that I had ever seen in our town about Harriet Wilson, the first black woman to publish a novel in the world. And she was born here and lived here in Milford.
That's Jerry Ann Bogus, executive director of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire. She met me on a windy afternoon in Milford.
I was blown away. And so I went out and got the book right away and I read it, and it was just absolutely fascinating. Just a story that opened up a new way to view our town, a new way to view our state, that black people actually were born and raised here in the 1700s and on. So not just passing through on their way to Canada, but were vital part of our New Hampshire culture.
Harriet Wilson had first come to light in the early 1980s when Professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. had rediscovered the novel and verified the identity of its author, a black woman.
He was in an antique bookstore, and sometimes he says the book fell on the ground right in front of him. But he's a good storyteller. But anyway, that was part of his doctoral dissertation to prove that. He said after he read it that it was written by a person of color. People had taught that it was written by a white male. It was actually cataloged in books as books written by white male about slavery.
But that rediscovery was made in the 1980s. And by the 2000s, few outside the scholarly community knew Harriet Wilson's name. Even people in Milford, like Jerry Ann. She didn't want Wilson's name to disappear again, so she formed the Harriet Wilson Project to celebrate and share her story. Harriet was born Harriet Adams in Milford in 1825. Her father was a free black man. Her mother's identity isn't certain, but some believe she was a white woman from Portsmouth who moved to Milford. Milford was, at the time, a stronghold of abolitionism.
In the 1800s, early 1800s, there was a abolitionist convention, an anti-slavery convention, which they said that all the major speakers on the trail were there. Garrison was there, Frederick Douglass was there, you know, a whole host. It was a two-day convention. The Hutchinson family, too, from Milford, were very popular abolitionist singers that toured along with Douglass, and you know, they were on that whole lecture circuit, and they were from Milford here.
Oh, the car emancipation rides majestic through our nation, bearing on its train the story, liberty, a nation's glory.
So Milford definitely, it's been quoted in the town histories as a hotbed for abolitionists.
Harriet's father died when she was 7. Her mother remarried but abandoned Harriet to work for the Hayward family as an indentured servant. She was 7 years old. We don't know much about her life beyond what she wrote in her book. She attended school for 3 summers and likely worked for a few other families.
From her book, when she leaves Milford, she moves to a W town, is what she puts in her book. And Wilson meets two people that were very influential in her life. One person, she writes in her book that she got the formula for hair products, and you know, she sells this product door to door. She'd be quite entrepreneurial.
Harriet's hair business is a more recent discovery about the novelist. She's said to have gotten the recipe for restoring gray hair to its natural color from a friend. Ads for Mrs. Wilson's hair regenerator appeared as early as 1857. The other influential person she met when she left New Hampshire was a woman who instilled a love of books and reading. In 1851, Harriet married Thomas Wilson, but he was a con man who abandoned her and their newborn son George a year later. Harriet, often ill and left destitute by her husband, had to leave George at a poor farm while she earned money selling hair products and maybe working as a dressmaker. It's at this time that she starts writing.
And at that time, the slave narratives were making former enslaved people wealthy. They, the abolitionist movement really flourished with those books.
Harriet thought she could make a living off of her story and asked for people to rally around her so she could support her child.
So Wilson's book, Our Negro Sketches in the Life of a Free Black, talks about Fredo, the hero, heroine in the story. She gets abandoned to the B family in the book. Her mother drops her off there, so the book tells about her life growing up with this family and how she went from being called her name to becoming our nig. And so it talks about the ill treatment by Mrs. B, the mother in the family, and one of the daughters. It's one passage in there where Mrs. B puts her out in the sun to make sure that she is never mistaken for one of her children. So that tells us two things. She was biracial, she was probably light-skinned, but it was important that she looked dark so nobody would mistake her. So that's the story. It's her coming of age of this young girl in a young biracial girl in a predominantly white town and home.
But the novel, published by an abolitionist printer in Boston, was a hard sell.
Wilson's writing, right, her book was contrary to the notion of what would have sold as a slave narrative, because they wanted the overcoming stories, right? And Wilson's book, even though it was so small, it tore apart all of the treasured institutions of the day. Let's take motherhood, right? Mrs. B, the protagonist in the novel, was an evil woman, to her children. So motherhood took a blow. The church, she called the church, hypocrites. The abolitionist movement, they were hypocritical, because she says, here, you're going to be fighting for this, but you won't have one of us to dinner in your home.
Documentary evidence has shown that many of the details of the book are literally true, aside from the names. A few months after the book's publication, Harriet's son George, the reason for her book, died.
Her son dies, right? The book came out 59 months, just a few months after publishing her book, her son dies. And that's what was the goal she had put in. I can imagine that she quite, took a really blow for that. And that was just not something that she would want to, that could have put a dampening on how much she put in the writing and stuff. But we do know she becomes a lecturer on the lecture circuits, and she talks about child abuse, and she talks about, she becomes actually a famous spiritualist.
Sadly, it was her son's death that provided the proof of Harriet's race. Gates found his death certificate, which lists his mother as a black woman. As far as we know, Harriet didn't keep writing after George died. She did return to her hair care business. She also joined the lecture circuit and became deeply involved with the spiritualist movement. She died in 1900. In 2006, the Harriet Wilson Project unveiled a statue of the writer. Sculptor Fern Cunningham, who'd previously done the Harriet Tubman Memorial in Boston, was commissioned for the work. But unlike Tubman, we don't know what Wilson looked like.
But we asked for a single monument of a woman. And Fern sent in a proposal that had George. And she said, her proposal said, well, if it wasn't for her son, Wilson wouldn't have written the book. So how could we have just a statue of just Harriet without her son? Because he was the impetus for her writing the book. So she won.
The statue on a patch of lawn in Bicentennial Park depicts Harriet holding her book. Her son George is just behind her in the folds of her dress. Jerry Ann tells me the figure is designed for engagement. This is a statue to jump up on. To prove it, she hops up the steps to read me the passage from the open pages of the book in Harriet's hands.
So on here you can go up, and this is the moment she, so Fern asked us what she should write in here, because she said, again, if you're interacting with the public, then you wouldn't have a blank sheet. She wanted something there. So stop, shouted Fredo. Strike me and I'll never work a mite more for you. And throwing down what she had gathered, stood like one who feels the stirring of free and independent thoughts. By this unexpected demonstration...
Jerry Ann has done much to change the story for Harriet Wilson. But Harriet has also changed Jerry Ann and her relationship with New Hampshire.
It really gave me a sense of belonging. Now, Wilson's story is not my story. I'm not African American. I was born in Jamaica and came here to college. But discovering that blacks were always a vital, integral part of New Hampshire's history changed the way I look at the state. It created roots in a place that it formerly had no roots for me. And once you belong, once you feel that you belong to a place, you are invested in it. You're invested in many, many ways. You're invested in it in, I mean, I've always thought it's beautiful town, beautiful state, the mountains. There's a lot of it that reminds me of home, the mountains, the oceans, the rivers, you know, so it's comfortable there. And that created that sense of connection in nature, but culturally was totally fractured from a culture here. But discovering Wilson's story here and all of the black history in Portsmouth and finding out all the other places, you know, Key and Jaffrey, everywhere else in the state, creates that, yeah, I belong here just as much as you do.
You can learn more about Harriet Wilson at harrietwilsonproject.net and visit the statue of Harriet Wilson herself at Bicentennial Park in Milford.
Before we go to the break, we're planning a show right now about dating, and we want to hear your guys' stories about dating in New Hampshire.
Right. So last week, there was a survey on young people in New Hampshire that was released that made headlines and caught my eye. It was put together by a nonprofit in New Hampshire called Stay Work Play. It was also sponsored by Eversource, which is an electric utility, which purportedly has trouble retaining young workers in New Hampshire. The survey was of 420 New Hampshire residents between 20 and 40 years old. The basic question of the survey was, what makes 20 and 30-somethings come to New Hampshire? What makes them stay here? And why do they leave? So the survey asked about employment, about living situation, and about relationships, which is what really caught my eye. Because one of the most powerful results was that 25% of respondents did not have family members living what they would call nearby, and a little over a fifth didn't have friends they'd consider close or easily accessible. 30% of the respondents said they'd probably or definitely would consider moving out of New Hampshire in the next 2 years, and a further 22% were unsure. And one of the top challenges the survey identified for young people in New Hampshire was what they called aloneness. The survey lists a couple reasons why that might be the case, including lack of public transportation, lack of nightlife, and a perceived lack of cultural opportunities. But it touches on something I've been wondering about for a while. What is it like for people who are single in New Hampshire, who are maybe looking to not be alone and to date in New Hampshire? So I just went out and asked a few people. The first place I went was True Brew in downtown Concord, and that's where I met Alex Heath, sitting on a bar stool.
Today's my birthday. Just turned 31.
Happy birthday!
Yep.
That's great, you're taking yourself out.
Yeah, I just got out of work.
And I asked him, how does he try to meet new people in New Hampshire?
I usually meet people when I'm out, just out and about. So, I've tried the dating apps. No good.
Not for you?
No. No way.
What was hard about it?
Well, you don't meet them. You see a photo. That doesn't mean anything, really.
Yeah.
it doesn't add up, really, trying to meet a real partner. You can't beat talking to somebody and being like, hey, you know, can I get your number? Right. Hang out.
Sure, like so much is like about how you get along in person.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, seeing a photo of somebody, you're like, it makes me laugh.
I've been with my husband now for 6 years. I actually didn't meet him in Concord, though. I went online. I met him online.
That's Chloe French. We met on Main Street just a few minutes after she got out of work. And she told me she met her husband when she was 19.
I started trying it. I had a few weirdos message me. He was the only one I actually talked to, the only one I actually hung out with.
A few blocks away, I met 22-year-old Josie Alfonso. Josie says that she prefers to meet people in person, but she's had lots of friends who've had success with online dating, and she knows the drill.
It starts with, like, you add someone on Facebook, and then, like, you find their Instagram, and you like one of their pictures, and, like, they like yours back, then you can, like, DM them, and they'll, like, message you back, and maybe they'll, like, add you on Snapchat or something. It's, like, a whole process, but I guess.
I had no idea the progression of, like, apps that you...
It's a real thing. Like, my friends will be like, oh, like, did he add you on Facebook yet or something? Or did they? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. Oh, here it is. And they're like, oh, cool. Like, maybe he'll find your Instagram now. And, like, we'll see how serious they are, you know? And it's like, all right, if that's the... if that's what we're doing, like...
So funny. So Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat.
Yeah, like, if someone, like, double likes a picture of yours on Instagram, like, they're interested. Like, you're in.
But I guess I wonder, like... In a small town like Concord, and you're like online, you're on a dating app, like maybe you're gonna run into people that you see on the dating app, you know? Like, is it different here than it is other places?
I grew up in a smaller town than Concord, a very, very small town.
So that's Chloe French again.
So for me, Concord's like a lot more happening than Warner. That's where I'm from.
You're from Warner, New Hampshire?
I'm from Warner, yeah. Yep. I don't know. I mean, I would say there's... Right now, it seems there's more younger people in Concord than there was in the last few years.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the dating scene will get a little better. More people out there.
As for Josie Alfonso, she's definitely familiar with some of the challenges of small town dating.
Are you from New Hampshire?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I actually am from Alton, New Hampshire. It's a small town in the Lakes region. I moved to Concord about a year ago because I actually broke up with my boyfriend in Alton, so...
It was because you broke up that you're like, I gotta get out of here?
Yeah, almost, yeah, because it is such a small town, and you know how that goes. It's kind of a toxic environment to be in, especially if you're around someone you don't want to see and you know you're gonna run into them all the time. So, but as far as other people, I know, you know, a lot of my classmates in high school who are together and are still together from when we graduated. It's kind of almost like, just because that's who's there, is maybe why they're with them still or together, because they haven't gone anywhere else or gotten out. So I think that small town, you know, kind of influence keeps people together in a way, which isn't always a bad thing, but
sure.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes there's like the idea that there are too many fish in the sea, and so you like have the choice of everyone,
exactly.
Which makes you not stay with anyone.
Yeah, or could be an intimidating thought, but if you think that way, then I guess you're not gonna find anyone anyway.
We want to keep exploring this question of what it's like to date in New Hampshire, and we are looking for your stories. We want to hear from you. What's it like to date in New Hampshire? If you've dated in other places, how does the state compare? Or if you've never dated outside of New Hampshire, what is it like? Send us your stories, your questions, your frustrations. You do not have to be in your 20s or 30s to send something in. We want to hear from everyone. There are lots of ways to get in touch. You can email us at wordofmouth@nhpr.org or call us. You can leave us a voicemail at 603-513-7796. All this information is at wordofmouthradio.org. The email again is wordofmouth@nhpr.org and the number is 603-513-7796. Coming up next on Word of Mouth, Concord's Gay Pride celebration is back for the second year in a row. We'll hear from the woman who made it happen. Stick around. This is Word of Mouth. I'm Justine Paradise.
And I'm Hannah McCarthy.
I'm Ben Henry.
So Ben, you live in Concord, right? Were you here last June?
I was, yep.
Okay, so did you happen to notice early June last year a bunch of people and a bunch of rainbows on the State House lawn at some point?
I think I'd remember if I did, and I don't think I did.
Okay, so that was the first will-be annual Pride Concord.
Concord didn't have a Pride, an annual Pride event before last year. I feel like Pride's been around a really long time, right?
Yeah, and so there had been some one-off events. Pride has been around for a really long time, for decades. And, you know, like, a city like Boston has Pride Week, which is really closer to 2 weeks sometimes, and a bunch of parades and festivals and events. But Concord, for, you know, a number of reasons, just never actually established anything just like that.
So last year was the first time that somebody said, all right, we're going to have a gay pride event and it is going to be a recurring thing. And that they said this is going to be annual.
Yeah, exactly right. And we happen to have the good luck of having a producer on our show, Jimmy Gutierrez, who knows the individual who kicked off the first annual Pride Concord event. And that is Allison Murphy. Had you ever done anything like this before?
No.
Allison is a familiar face in her community. She stays super busy running Concord Handmade, teaching yoga, doing roller derby, and raising two kids with her wife. They've been here for 10 years now, and Allison has done a lot in this city. But she's never tried something like this.
So the first one was in June of 2017. In June of 2016, we started talking about it. So I live in Concord with my wife, and she had never been to a gay pride event before. So we decided we had to change that, but she was too scared to go to like the really big ones in Boston or Washington, D.C. or something. So as wives do, I had to do whatever she tells me. So so I started our own.
Concord is small by city standards. Welcoming and supportive, Allison will tell you, but small. There had been one-off Pride events in Concord before, but nothing really built to last.
So we wanted to do something that was more sustainable and that we would be doing year after year as a celebration in Concord.
Building a Pride event from scratch is a huge undertaking. And Allison, though she knows how to open a storefront, had zero experience with organizing a massive event. Luckily, her sister happened to have some downtime.
So it takes a sister who has worked in nonprofits for a lot of years, who knows a lot about everything. So she jokes that I started Pride to give her something to do. So, which I didn't, but it was helpful.
First step was making sure no one else in town had plans to organize a Pride. Next was incorporating Pride Concord, getting nonprofit status, establishing bylaws, and a board of directors. Allison says that most of last year was spent figuring out the federal stuff and going to meetings. Lots and lots of meetings.
It was worth it in the end, but it was a lot of work last year to get all of that set up.
Allison and her team scoped out other Pride celebrations in the country and in the state. Portsmouth and Rochester have hosted events for the past few years, for example. They also researched what might actually be possible in Concord, which kept boiling down to something on the State House lawn. And then they had to rip off the Band-Aid.
So we started, it was funny, we reserved the State House lawn, and then we made a Facebook event, as you do. And then the Facebook event started to get more interest. And then all of a sudden, there were 400 people who said they were going. So we had this moment of, okay, now we're doing it. Like, once it's on Facebook, it's real. So
if you've lived in a major city, chances are you're totally familiar with LGBTQ Pride events. Concord not having one may seem like an exception to the rule. And Allison says she can't be sure why Concord's been so long without a regular annual event. But nobody seemed interested in getting in the way last year.
I have a friend who used to say the great thing about Concord is if there's something you want in Concord, you can make it happen. But you have to do the work to make it happen. And so that is exactly what happened with Pride. We needed to do the work to get it to happen because I don't really know why there wasn't one. I'm sure there was a lot of people like my wife who had never been to a Pride and didn't know how fabulous they are. So maybe that had something to do with it, too.
Come June 3rd, 2017, Pride Concord descended on the statehouse lawn. They had a local band, Sensitive Men, and the New Hampshire Gay Men's Chorus, with an after party at Tandy's. There were some small hitches to the event, Allison says. After all, they'd never done this before. The audio system cut out at some point, and they didn't really figure out a way to count the crowd. But Allison estimates they had somewhere between 700 and 1,000 attendees for the inaugural annual Pride, none of whom seemed to be there in protest.
Given the political climate, it was easy for us to get caught up in worrying about that. But we try to just say, Concord, we're proud to be here. We had the State House reserved. We knew what to do if any sort of riffraff showed up. And we took care of the people who were there. And it was really just a matter of, the closer we got to the day, we had to stop worrying about whether or not there were going to be any counter-protesters there or any sort of people who were disgruntled about it, because it wasn't going to serve us. And we knew that there were going to be so many people there and so many families there that we just tried to focus on making it as positive of an experience for them as we could.
Part of making last year's Pride positive, Allison says, was keeping it all ages. The goal was for anyone to be able to bring anyone, for parents to bring kids and vice versa, and for people to be able to look around and see just how expansive their community is.
I think part of the reason why we wanted to start it, and one of the reasons it's important in smaller communities like Concord, is that visibility is really important. And just having, knowing that you're not the only gay person in your town or your neighborhood or your school is really important. So just being able to remind people that there's a big community, and it's important to have people who are there that aren't, that don't identify as LGBTQ, because allies are just as important. So having it be very clear that Concord is very happy that we all live here is why we did it.
Though she can't be sure, Allison has the sense that last year's Pride really did reinforce a message for Concord's LGBTQ community.
One thing that my wife and I are constantly looking out for is people, same-sex couples, holding hands in public. And so every time we see one out, we're like, that's because of us, which is not really the case. But we like to think that it reminded people that Concord is for everyone, and it's really open and welcoming to all of these different people.
Now, if you're familiar with other prides in the country, a giant parade probably comes to mind. Pride Concord is a stationary event for the time being. But they're working on it. And as Allison knows, all it takes is someone who's willing to put it together.
So if anybody wants to organize a parade connected to Pride, call me. And we would love to have you go to all the meetings you have to go to. Oh my God, so many meetings.
As intended, Pride Concord is continuing on into this year. And this time, Allison and her team are going to come fully prepared.
Porta potties. Okay. It means having enough porta potties and just being ready for a big crowd. Having lots of merch, having plenty of rainbows for everybody, and having porta potties so that there isn't a line for the porta potties.
So is this year's Pride going to be even bigger than last year's?
Yeah, Allison has said that at this point, the word has spread near and far, and they've made sure that this Pride won't be conflicting with other Prides in New England, so the sky is kind of the limit. She says that this time, if all goes as planned, they can have, you know, around 5,000 people if they want.
Where do we find this? State House?
Yeah, so this year's Concord Pride is going to be on June 2nd from 2 to 6 p.m. on the Statehouse lawn, and then there's an after party at the Capitol Center for the Arts. So that part is 21+, and Allison says to expect lots of dancing, lots of glitter, and lots of drag queens. And Allison says they still need loads of volunteers for the day of. You can find a sign-up sheet on Facebook at Pride Concord NH.
Great, Hannah McCarthy, thanks for diving into Pride.
You got it.
That is it for Word of Mouth. This week's episode was produced by Hannah McCarthy with Ben Henry, Taylor Quimby, Jimmy Gutierrez, and me, Justine Paradise. Music in this episode is from Blue Dot Sessions, Chad Crouch, Persona La Ave, and the Hutchinson Family Singers. Our executive producer is Erica Janik. Maureen McMurray is a field guide to lenticular clouds.
You can learn more about Barbara Follett, Harriet Wilson, and Pride Concord on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, and reach out to us with your New Hampshire firsts and questions about the state by emailing wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Remember, we are looking for stories about dating in the Granite State, and we hope to hear from you. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Justine Paradise. Thanks for listening.